Okay, tonight we'll start by looking at chapter 12, which I was thinking about maybe skipping this chapter because we're kind of running out of time. We can't cover all the chapters in the text. But this does contain just a fundamental concept of, you know, what is the mechanism by which stars produce their prodigious amount of energy. And so I thought it would be worth our time to spend an hour or so taking a look at this. Before we do, we'll take a few minutes to look at star formation. And this is the current model of how stars form. You start with a large cloud of hydrogen gas. Remember, the universe is about 92% hydrogen. So it's by far the most common element in the universe. Helium is another 8 or 7%, let's say, and 1% is everything else on the periodic table. So you have a large cloud of hydrogen that forms, and then it begins to contract due to its internal gravity. And then the contraction continues, and that angular momentum causes it to spin. You remember we talked about the principle of conservation of angular momentum in a previous chapter. The velocity, the mass, and the distance of any object must be conserved. So in this hydrogen cloud that's condensing, the mass is the same. The diameter is decreasing, so the velocity must increase to achieve conservation of momentum. And so what happens is this disk begins to spin as the contraction continues. And it's just like if you ever go to a pizza store and you see those workers, those employees, taking that ball of dough, and what do? They start spinning it. And as it spins, it flattens into a disk. And that is exactly what's happening here in this third picture. And as it begins rotating faster and faster, it reconfigures itself into a disk, what is called a protoplanetary disk, or proplid. The large clumps of heavier compounds in the disk accrete. You see these clumps up here. Larger clumps start forming, and they start attracting smaller clumps, and they slam together. And due to their temperature, high temperature still at this stage, they tend to accrete or coalesce together into what are called planetesimals or protoplanets. And then eventually the new star's solar wind or radiation blows away any dust left behind, and you're left with the new star and solar system consisting of planets, if in fact it's a bachelor star as opposed to a multiple star. The internal pressure in that star eventually gets hot enough that hydrogen begins fusing in the core and the star begins burning. Here's an artist's conception what a protoplanetary disk looks like. So you see it's surrounded by that vestigial hydrogen, and we see the protoplanetary disk that's forming like the flattened pizza dough. And in that disk, you see protoplanets forming, planetesimals they're called, forming and becoming larger. And as they get larger gravitationally, they attract more junk, and they become larger and larger. And eventually, the radiation from the star blows away the remaining gas and dust, and you are left with a star and solar system. Now, let's look at some photographic examples. These are mostly from the Hubble Space Telescope, showing condensing gas clouds. This is the pre-protoplanetary disk phase. And I wish I had my laser pointer, but you can see, for example, up there in the upper left-hand corner and coming down the whole left-hand side of that picture, these clumps of hydrogen that are starting to coalesce. The same is true here of these darker areas. And that's a stellar nursery right up there. Stars newly formed and some in the process of forming. And here are some examples of protoplanetary disks. These are new solar systems that are in the process of formation in the Orion Nebula, M42. So you see here the central star, the illuminated portion, surrounded by this dark disk. And that's what astronomers believe are protoplanetary disks surrounding these relatively young stars. So what we're looking at are literally solar systems in the making. All of these are in the Orion Nebula. And so this diagram depicts what is going on here. On the left-hand side, you've got the contracting hydrogen gas slowly contracting due to gravity. And then in the middle, you have the gravitational contraction forming enough heat that the temperature hits about the 10 million Kelvin threshold, which is hot enough to trigger sustained fusion reactions. And at that point, you have nuclear energy. And at that point, you also have the hydrostatic equilibrium, where the contracting force of gravity is perfectly offset by the outward force from the fusion reactions in the core. And you have hydrostatic equilibrium. The star is stable. It goes on to the main sequence of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, and it will stay there for, as we saw last week, for about 90% of its life. That's the stable burning phase of a star. I think this last picture showing you a fusion automobile, your grandkids may drive those. You know, they'd be powered with water. That's the solution to our energy needs of the world. A gallon of water would supply the energy needs of the world for years. The problem is getting that up to a sufficient temperature that we can sustain fusion reactions. And for that to happen, you need to have that 10 to 15 million degrees Kelvin. And at this point, there have been short-term fusion reactions that have been triggered in laboratory experiments, but it takes more energy to create the fusion than the fusion produces. That equation is slowly changing, and eventually we're going to cross that threshold where more energy is released than is needed to heat the temperature up. That's exactly what's going on in stars. And if that could be controlled, you know, our energy crisis or needs would be completely a thing of the past. You use basically heavy water as your fuel, and the waste products are oxygen. The only known sources of nuclear fusion at this point, of course, are thermonuclear explosions, H-bomb, hydrogen bombs, and, of course, the stars. All right, what is the incredible energy source in the stars? You know, it's an age-old mystery. You look at the sun here. What is the source of its incredible energy? It was only in the last 100 years or so that scientists were able to, for the first time, fairly accurately estimate the actual amount of energy being produced by the sun, for example, in 1 second, Earth second. And it turns out that in 1 second of the sun's energy, it yields 4 × 10^26 watts of energy. That's equal to the annual output of 2.5 billion of the largest nuclear power plants on Earth. So you take the largest nuclear power plant on Earth, and then you assume you have 2.5 billion of them, and then you take their entire annual output of energy, that equals 1 second of energy emanating from the sun. It's hard to describe this. It's 100 billion megatons of TNT. That's the equivalent to 4 billion Hiroshima nuclear bombs going off every second. We can't get our minds around this. The bottom line is this. What force could produce this much energy? Well, there were several theories historically for hundreds or if not thousands of years since the ancient world. It was assumed that the sun's energy comes from oxidation. It's like a giant ball of burning wood or burning fuel of some kind. Aristotle believed that. In the 18th century, it was determined that any fuel would be consumed in a few thousand years, given the rate of energy output of the sun, as was calculated even that long ago. So that was not considered an adequate description. The sun would burn out in just a couple of thousand years. By the 19th century, two new theories emerged. Let me describe each of these for you. The first theory to explain the energy output of the sun was the concept of the conservation of energy. And the idea was this. If you had enough asteroids and comets impacting the sun, converting mechanical energy into heat and light, well, that may be enough to explain the sun's energy. The problem with that was that it would require one Earth mass per century that would change the Earth's orbit and orbital period around the sun, and this had never been detected over hundreds of years. So that was eventually dropped. And so by the end of the 19th century, at the dawn of the 20th century, one of the leading theories was gravitational contraction, that if the sun contracted by only 40 meters per year out of a sun that's almost 900,000 miles in diameter, if it contracted just 40 meters per year, shrunk that much, that would produce enough energy to account for the sun's output. Well, the problem is that was true, but that would only produce enough energy for 100 million years. And by the early 20th century, the age of the sun and Earth was widely accepted by most scientists to be closer to 4 to 5 billion years. And so this was rejected as a possible explanation. And furthermore, absolutely no contraction was observed with increasingly sophisticated experiments. And these have continued to this day that have shown that the sun, in fact, is not contracting. And so solar contraction cannot explain the output of energy of the sun. So at the dawn of the 20th century, the question remained, what mysterious force is causing the sun's tremendous energy output? Charles Darwin goes to his death in the latter 19th century obsessed with this question, because he knew that unless some explanation was given for a long-burning sun, his theory of evolution would be in shambles. He died not knowing the answer to this question, which came just a few years later in a paper written in 1905 by a 25-year-old Swiss patent examiner, Albert Einstein, his special theory of relativity, one of those four monographs that he wrote that year, any one of which would be deserving of the Nobel Prize. He did not win the Nobel Prize for this theory of relativity, but rather for the photoelectric effect. He also did a paper on Brownian motion. You know, if you put a drop of blue food coloring in a glass of water, the motion of that blue dye, what causes that? I don't remember what the fourth paper was, but it was the special theory of relativity that explained, finally, the energy output of the sun. And the famous equation, probably the most famous equation in all of physics, E equals mc squared, the equivalence of energy and mass. And what Einstein shows us is, think outside the box. Take two seemingly totally unrelated substances, matter and energy, and they can essentially be considered equivalents. And not just that, but because energy equals the mass in kilograms times the speed of light in kilometers squared, this is an unbelievably huge number. What does this mean? The smallest amounts of matter can be converted into unbelievable amounts of energy. You know, under Newtonian mechanics, Isaac Newton believed that a body at rest had no kinetic energy. It had no energy. Only when it was in motion did it have energy. But Einstein showed that any amount of matter, even if it's at rest, has just an unbelievable energy equivalent. Let's take a look at what this looks like. A raisin would have the equivalent of 20,000 tons of TNT. Or how about this? 2 pounds of matter would provide the U.S. energy needs for 2 weeks. What does that mean? If you're 100 pounds, your body has sufficient energy to provide the energy needs of America for 2 years. If you're 200 pounds and your body were converted to pure energy, you could provide the energy needs of our nation for 4 years. Don't tell me you're tired. You are bounding with energy of a type and kind and quantity that you cannot even fathom. 10 pounds, 100 million tons of TNT. Think of it, a bucket of water. Nuclear bombs, nuclear power plants. Let's take a look at the interlinear Greek Testament. New Testament. But ye shall, Acts chapter 1, verse 8, but ye shall receive power, dunamis, after that the Holy Ghost has come upon you. Is this part of what Luke is talking about here in Acts chapter 1? We have power because of the presence of God within us. We also have this awesome power because our bodies are the equivalent of energy. Now, it turns out that matter or mass is converted to energy in two ways. And those are fission and fusion. Fission is the splitting of heavy elements. Those were the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombs that ended World War II. Splitting those heavy atoms, and as I've told you, we won World War II because our German scientists were better than their German scientists. You know, who was it that developed the nuclear bomb in the Manhattan Project? Were scientists from Germany that had emigrated largely because they were a part, they were considered Jewish under the Nazi racial laws. Boy, just think about it. If it hadn't been for those laws, and the Reich would have retained those scientists, and the Germans would have developed nuclear weapons in 1942 or 43, England would have been completely destroyed with missiles, and on the Eastern Front, the Soviets would have been destroyed quickly, and the war would have been over by the end of 43, probably. Fusion, of course, is the combining of lighter elements, the lighter protons, just like wet snowballs slamming together, and they are fused. And as it turns out, that produces a far greater amount of energy than fission. Fission requires heavy atoms like uranium that don't exist in the sun. How do we know that? The spectral lines, those absorption lines in the spectra, the spectrum of the sun, that tell us what it's made of. Hardly anything, any uranium in there. So the sun's energy must come from fusion. In hydrogen fusion, you've got two protons that are of the same charge, two positively charged protons, that are electrostatically repulsed. Like charges repel, you remember? And unlike charges attract. Well, how is it then that you can have fusion at all? How can we have two hydrogen nuclei, two protons, that come together and literally fuse to release that prodigious amount of energy? How do they overcome that force of repulsion between two positively charged protons? And the answer is what is called the strong nuclear force. This is a very powerful but very short-range force. It has a range of only the width of a proton. That force has no significance whatsoever when you get out to larger contexts. I mean, it is a very short-range force. And that force eventually is able to overcome the electrostatic repulsion of this, of the positive charges of those hydrogen protons. It's a very short radius, but it's a very high-energy force. Now think about this. That force of repulsion between the positively charged protons is so powerful that you've got to heat the core of the sun up to a minimum of 10 million degrees Kelvin, 20 million degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, the protons, these hydrogen nuclei, are colliding on average of 100 million times per second in the core of the sun. And at that rate, they're binding or fusing only once every 14 billion years. Why do we have any fusion going on at all? It's a bell curve. Some fuse sooner, some later. What that results in is a stable burning star over a long period of time on the main sequence. And that's what's happening in our sun. But I just want you to see here the improbability of it all. Think of it. You have a, take a hydrogen nucleus, a proton. It's jiggling around at 10 million degrees Kelvin, 20 million degrees, 18 million degrees Fahrenheit. And it is so hot that it's so energetic, it's moving so fast, it's bouncing off other protons at the rate of 100 million times per second, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and yet there's only a fusion event, a combination once every 14 billion years on average. Can you believe that? This is not. This force is very exquisitely fine-tuned, may I say, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But this, I often think about this. You know, some of you may be attracted to somebody here on campus, and you try to sit next to that person in class, or you try to sit next to that person in the cafeteria. You try to be with that person. There's a lot of interaction going on, 100 million times per second, but there's no binding happening. That takes once every 14 billion years. So you ever feel that way? And there's such a perfect analogy to romance here. So if you ever feel that way, like, you know, I'm spending so much time with this person, but nothing's happening. Just think of the sun. Think of nuclear fusion as your example. You know, just you haven't waited long enough. I'm trying to give you hope, class. Okay, so here's an example. Here's a diagram of what's going on. Countless times in the core of our sun. You start out with these helium protons, or hydrogen protons, the nucleus of the hydrogen atom. And about once every 14 billion years, after jostling together 100 million times per second for 14 billion years, they actually fuse, some sooner, some later. And they fuse into what? Not helium, but to deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen. It contains a proton and a neutron in the nucleus. And that event, you start with two protons, you end up with a proton and a neutron, and it releases two additional things. It releases a neutrino, and it releases a positron. This is fascinating. You know what a positron is? It's antimatter. It's a positively charged electron. What happens to it? It immediately contacts a negatively charged electron, and they're annihilated into pure energy. But going on in this core of our sun, trillion, countless times per second, are the emergence of antimatter particles, positrons, positive electrons, as part of the fusion reaction. Now, it only takes about 6 seconds for one of these deuterium atoms, which is the proton and the neutron in the heavy hydrogen nucleus, that for them to combine with the bachelor proton. That only takes 6 seconds after 14 billion years old to produce what's called helium-3, which is an isotope of helium, and it releases a gamma ray. Now, it takes about a million years after that, according to the current model, for those two helium-3 atoms to combine and form helium-4, which is the helium that we know. And when that happens, two protons are discharged, and the whole process starts all over again. This is going on countless times in our sun. This is the process by which the energy is released. The energy is not E equals MC squared. It's E equals delta MC squared, delta meaning the change, the mass deficit. When you start at step number one here and you come down to step number three, the weight of the helium atom is about 0.007% less than the combined weight of the two hydrogen nuclei. It shouldn't be. It should be the same. But because it's slightly less, 0.007%, that is the missing mass. That's the mass deficit. That is the mass that has been converted to pure energy through this process of E equals MC squared. Now, it turns out, and by the way, this is why the sun is 75% hydrogen and 23% helium. The 75% hydrogen is the unfused hydrogen, and 23% is the helium byproduct of the fusion reactions. You know, on the Enterprise, their engines were what? Matter-antimatter engines. Here's a picture of it right here. So we see right here that, yes, we have seen an example that antimatter is not science fiction. It actually exists. In fact, it's almost an infinite phenomenon every second in the core of our sun. And let me tell you, you take a positron and an electron, an anti-electron and a regular electron, and as soon as they come in contact, there's total annihilation. That mass is completely converted to energy. As I said, it's hard for the strong nuclear force to overcome that repulsive force. It takes forever for that to happen. Why don't electrons that are negatively charged, we've looked at this in chapter 2, immediately combine with protons that are positively charged, resulting in atomic collapse? And the reason is the Bohr model of the atom that we looked at in chapter 2. Remember that electrons can't just go down and combine with the proton. They only can be at discrete energy levels. And they can only move up and down those energy levels by absorbing or emitting photons of a specific wavelength and energy, which is not a common phenomenon. And that's why atoms don't just immediately disintegrate. A related problem, why do elements other than hydrogen exist? Protons are positive, and they repel one another. Why should we have any element with more than one proton? What is it that's keeping those protons together? How can the universe exist of anything other than hydrogen, atoms with a single proton? Well, as it turns out, the universe is mostly hydrogen, 92%. But it's 8% other stuff. 6 or 7% of that is helium, and maybe 1 to 2% is everything else on the periodic table. The answer, what is it that enables protons to fuse together to form the heavier elements is the strong nuclear force, one of the four fundamental laws of nature. And here we see a depiction of the composition of the universe that we've seen before. For every million hydrogen atoms, there are about 80,000 helium atoms, and then you go down from there, 690 oxygen. Oxygen is the third most abundant element. Carbon is the fourth most abundant element. And then you go down from there. People say, well, why can't we have silicon-based life? Well, we could, but look at this. Silicon is 45 atoms per 1 million hydrogen atoms compared to carbon, which is 420. So carbon is 10 times more prevalent. And by the way, carbon much more easily binds with other elements to form, you know, various other organic molecules and compounds. So you have, just to summarize, these two powerfully opposing forces. You have the strong nuclear force and the Coulomb force, that's the electrostatic repulsion. These two blue dots are the two protons, hydrogen protons, which are the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. It only has one proton. And because they're positively charged, that Coulomb force of electrostatic repulsion is trying to keep them away from each other. And it's the strong nuclear force that over an extended amount of time eventually captures them and fuses them together. What is the best explanation of this? I believe it's Colossians 1, 16 and 17. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. And here's the key. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That is the best description I have ever seen of the strong nuclear force. Scientists just give it a name, the strong nuclear force. They don't have the slightest idea what causes it. This, to me, is the most satisfying explanation of all. In him, Jesus Christ, all things are held together. What a statement of Scripture made 2,000 years before we had the slightest idea of what we're talking about here in terms of the structure of matter. It also, I think, is a powerful statement with regard to the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. And what I mean is this. In fact, I think this is the greatest proof of the Trinity. If God was not a Trinity, when Jesus died on the cross, if you believe that Jesus was God and the only God, and Jesus died on the cross, and for 3 days was in the tomb, in him, all things hold together. He's dead. For 3 days, the universe would have ceased to exist. The only reason it didn't was because there was an element of the Godhead that wasn't dead. God the Father and God the Son. And that's what held it together for those days when the Son of God was paying the penalty for the sins of every human being who ever lived. Let's talk, summarize what we've been mentioning here. You've got in the typical fusion reaction going on in the sun. Again, what are we talking about? What is it that produces that prodigious amount of energy that we measure outflowing from the sun continuously? It wasn't oxidation. It wasn't mechanical energy from the absorption of comets and asteroids. It wasn't solar contraction. At the dawn of the 20th century, science had no idea what it was. And then the special theory of relativity with the mass energy equivalence concept explained this. Two hydrogen atoms, one proton each, fuse to produce one helium atom through a multi-step process. As I said, the mass of the helium, the resulting helium atom is slightly less than the mass of the two hydrogen nuclei. And so there's what's called a mass deficit, about 0.007%, as I recall. The missing mass has been converted into energy. So I think it's a more accurate statement in terms of solar fusion to say E equals delta MC squared, because that's referring to energy equals the mass deficit or the loss of mass times the speed of light squared that occurs during the fusion process. 600 million tons of hydrogen fuses into helium every second in the core of the sun. The mass deficit is 4 million tons, which is what is converted into pure energy. But think about that. 600 million tons of hydrogen fusing into helium every second, 24 hours a day, in the core of the sun. Isn't it going to burn up? Well, it is, but at that rate, the sun is so massive, it's going to be at least 3 to 5 billion years before we see major changes in the sun's size, maybe a little less than that. But eventually, as we'll see in the next chapter, the sun is going to start burning up its fuel, its hydrogen, 75%. What happens then? That hydrostatic equilibrium, where the crushing inward force of gravity is perfectly offset by the outward force of the fusion reactions. As those fusion reactions start to peter out, because the hydrogen is being consumed, what happens? The battle is won by gravity, and the star starts to collapse down through that hydrostatic equilibrium. And as it crushes smaller and smaller, what happens? It heats up that core greater and greater, and a tremendous heat then outflows from the core that bloats out the unfused hydrogen, forming a red giant star. That's the outcome of our sun. That red giant star that will have a circumference roughly the equal to, in the size of our sun, probably the orbit of Venus. So the sun will bloat out beyond Mercury until its outer atmosphere is at the distance of the planet Venus, if you can believe that. It'll become a red giant. So eventually that battle is lost, and it becomes very cool, probably a surface temperature of just 3,000 degrees Kelvin, very luminous. It goes up into the upper right-hand corner of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which means it's cool and luminous. It just continues to condense and contract in the core more and more. And we'll talk about that process in the next chapter. And the outcome of a star, as it turns out, depends on its initial mass, whether there's sufficient gravity in there to cause it to crush down into a smaller and smaller and smaller space, crushing down into a white dwarf or to a neutron star or to a black hole. And we'll, as I say, return to that story in the next chapter. Heavier elements can fuse, but they require much more energy to do so. It turns out that iron is the heaviest element that can be produced through fusion in the sun. And that, why is that? Because the strong nuclear force is the strongest for iron, making it impossible for elements to fuse beyond iron at the temperatures that are reached in stars. And that explains the abundance of iron. You remember we looked at that chart of the relative abundances of the various elements? Iron was like fourth or fifth place. Elements heavier than iron can experience fission. They can split up into smaller elements. but there are very few of them. The question is, how are elements heavier than iron made? Where is it? There it is. Look at 32 atoms of iron for every 1 million atoms of hydrogen. So you look at our chart of relative abundances of the elements, it is as abundant as magnesium. So it'd be what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It'd be 6th or 7th place in terms of the abundances of the elements. So the bottom line is, nothing heavier than iron can result from the normal fusion reactions that take place in stars. Where did all these other elements come from? With a heavier atomic number than 20, with a higher atomic number than 26, where did your engagement ring come from? Whether it's silver or gold. Silver or gold, have we none? That's right. You know, look at silver. It's 47 atomic number. Gold, 79. You ever take a 1 ounce? I do this for my fourth grade Sunday school class. I bring a 1 ounce silver coin and a 1 ounce gold coin. And the gold coin is so much smaller for the same weight, so much denser. The atomic number is almost twice as high. But the point is, how do we get cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc, all of these elements heavier than iron, including silver and gold? According to the current model, there's only one way for those elements to be produced, and that's a supernova explosion. We'll come back to that mechanism and explain it in a little more detail in the next chapter, but let me just briefly describe this for you. Here's an example of a recent supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a southern hemisphere object. We can't see it from Missouri, but it's a galaxy that's maybe a couple hundred thousand miles away from our Milky Way galaxy. And if you were below the equator, you know, this would be an object that's a naked eye object. You could see it in the sky, and under a dark sky. But this was a star. You can see it in the top picture there with that arrow, how it erupted down here in the bottom picture to a luminosity of 10 billion suns over the course of several weeks. And it maintained that level before its light curve dropped off a couple months later. What is it that causes a star to increase in brilliance or luminosity 10 billion times? Well, we'll talk about that in the next chapter. Here's a picture of a very famous supernova that happened in our galaxy on July 4th, 1054 AD. The greatest 4th of July extravaganza in history. It preceded by 7 centuries the founding of the United States, so I don't think we can correlate the two. But also, something very important did happen in 1054 AD, and that was the Great Schism between the Roman Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. That happened in 1054. And if God gave us this celestial fireworks as an epiphany, we still don't know what it means 1,000 years later, whether it was showing his approval or disapproval. Maybe Dr. Horton can illuminate. To Adam, Genesis 3, 17 to 19, to Adam, God said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground. Here's the key. Since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. That is a perfect description of the current model of where the elements came from, heavier than iron, much of which exist in your body right now. The only mechanism for the creation of those elements is supernova eruptions. And that's why astronomers say that we are literally the dust of exploded stars. That's the material that God used in creation. We don't know of any other way. There's no scientific explanation for the origin of those elements heavier than iron. And is that what Moses means here? For dust you are, and to dust you will return. On August 2nd, 1939, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he said this: in the course of the last 4 months, it has been made probable, through the work of Joliot in France, as well as Fermi and Szilard in America, that it may become possible to set up nuclear chain reactions in a large mass of uranium. And this new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs. A single bomb of this type, carried by boat or exploded in a port, might very well destroy the whole port together with some of the surrounding territory. Largely through this letter, Roosevelt, who didn't have the slightest idea about nuclear physics, decides to fund the Manhattan Project, which, with the various German emigres and a few others, we were able to develop the atomic bomb and detonate it in June or July of 1945 in New Mexico, as I recall. And that led to the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945 and the end of World War II. There's a picture, by the way, right here of the Large Magellanic Cloud. And so the idea is this. We'll return to this in part in the next chapter. But it's these supernova eruptions that are not very common. They're massive stars that result in a supernova explosion, probably 15 to 40 times bigger than our sun to start with. Those are rare stars. And through that cataclysmic explosion, the heat generated is so great that it forces heavier elements to fuse. And it seeds the entire neighborhood of that star with heavier elements. And so as these new protoplanetary disks start forming, they have enriched material in their neighborhood. And that's why second and third generation stars have rocky planets with heavy metals and with all of the heavier elements, heavier than iron, in their composition. The anthropic principle says that the universe is finely tuned for life. There are over 1,000 parameters that need to be, and they're growing every month, that need to be exquisitely fine-tuned for life to be possible, for a life-supporting planet to be possible. We'll come back to these in the last chapter of the book, the last week of our class. I just want to show you right here, we've seen an example of one of these anthropic principles. And that is what? It's the strong nuclear force. Let's take a look at this. Under the current system, under the current strong nuclear force, we have this breakdown of the elements that we've seen before, which is perfectly suited for our planet, for example, and all of the building blocks that are necessary for life. Now, what if the strong nuclear force was slightly stronger? If it was slightly stronger, you wouldn't be having these protons bouncing off each other 100 million times per second and fusing once every 14 billion years. They'd be fusing a lot more often. And what would happen? You'd have an energy flash and heavier elements forming immediately. Fusion would become much more common, and life would become completely impossible. If the strong nuclear force was just the tiniest fraction of a percent stronger, that's the fine tuning of the strong nuclear force. We've seen why, if it's the strong nuclear force is slightly stronger. What if it's slightly weaker? Well, if it's slightly weaker, it's bad enough now with those hydrogen atoms bouncing off each other once every 100 million times per second and fusing once every 14 billion years. If the force is weaker, what's going to happen? They're never going to fuse. And the universe, instead of being 92% hydrogen, is going to be 100% hydrogen. There'll be nothing in the universe except hydrogen gas. No life. No life-sustaining planets. No planets. This is one example, class, of the powerful concept of the anthropic principle, which is embedded in the concept of intelligent design. Despite what you hear from skeptics, because this ultimately is a theological issue, if they do not believe in God, they're not going to believe in intelligent design. and they're not going to believe in the anthropic principle. If you do believe in God, then this is very natural to believe that these parameters for life are exquisitely fine-tuned, and there is intelligent design that permeates the universe. We'll see many examples of this in the last chapter. We'll return to those. But the point is this. When Jesus, for example, raised Lazarus from the dead, some believed on him. Not everybody did. Not everybody that saw the miracles of Christ believed in who he was. Jesus could come today and walk down the streets of this city and perform miracles. Not everybody would believe in him. Why? Because it's a matter of the will. And some people don't want to be told how to live their life. They want it to be my will, not thy will be done. God's going to give them their preference, isn't he, one day? Your will is going to be done, not mine. And so to those for whom the presence of God is a reality, how easy is it for us to believe in intelligent design and the anthropic principles become powerful tools? And I'll tell you this, there are more and more scientists that are becoming believers because of this. One of them, who's not a scientist, but is probably the most famous atheist other than Bertrand Russell in the 20th century, Anthony Flew, an Oxford sociologist, became a theist a few years ago. He'd been a prominent atheist. I admire his fortitude and his honesty and candor in acknowledging I can no longer be an atheist. He didn't embrace faith in Christ, but he did say, I'm now a theist, for three reasons. Number one, the Big Bang, let's face it, it happened. The evidence is incontrovertible. If there was a beginning, there was a beginner. It's a theistic conclusion. That's why Einstein could not accept the concept of the Big Bang, almost to his dying day, because he saw the implications of it. A beginning requires a beginner. And he was so revolted at the thought of God, of a personal God, that he ordered his scientific understanding accordingly. And we see that with people today, with the intelligent design debate. They cannot accept intelligent design because of their theological presuppositions that there is no God. The second thing Anthony Flew based his decision on was the anthropic principle, that the evidence for the exquisitely fine-tuned nature of the universe to support life, these thousand factors, we're going to look at some of them the last week of class. We've just seen one here. This is just unbelievable. And when you have that plus a thousand others, and you subtract for interdependency, and you multiply the probabilities, as we'll see, you end up with the probability of a life-sustaining planet, not to mention life originating, being on the order of 10 to the minus 500 power, something of that order or greater. It makes no sense. It's a number that's irrational. And what it means is generally scientists believe anything greater than 10 to the 40th power means it's certain. And so what do we see here? Science is proving a divine origin of the universe. And more scientists are coming to this belief. And let me tell you, class, more will in the future because these parameters keep growing. The third thing Flew said was this. Despite the Herculean efforts of scientists for the last 75 years in laboratories around the world to create life spontaneously under the most ideal conditions in a laboratory, prebiotic soups with electric energy, they can't do it. He concluded, life does not arise spontaneously, at least not easily. And so you can't just accept Carl Sagan's simplicity that, you know, that you have a prebiotic soup of organic compounds, you add electricity, voila, you have life. And then through evolution, you have intelligent life. It's happened here. It's happened countless times in the universe. That excessively optimistic view, for which Jesus Christ would say, never in all Israel have I seen such faith. It's being considered parochial by a growing number of scientists. But again, it was a theological proposition because Karl was an atheist, and he could not. He was revolted and repulsed and sickened by the thought of a God. He wanted to live his life the way he desired. So, Anthony Flew. It's for him to reject atheism and become a theist, it's been likened to the Pope announcing tonight, you know, I've rejected Christianity. I've rejected the existence of God. I've become an atheist. Or Billy Graham doing the same thing. That was the impact of Anthony Flew's decision. What I'm trying to tell you here, class, is we pulled the curtain back just a little bit tonight, and we've looked at one parameter, and that's the strong nuclear force. And we see how this is one example of the anthropic principle, that the universe is finely, is exquisitely fine-tuned for life. And the slightest variation in these thousand-plus variables or factors will make life impossible. Okay, the sun's interior, 10 to 15 million degree Kelvin core temperature required for fusion, probably 15 million degrees needed to produce that outward pressure to achieve the hydrostatic equilibrium and prevent gravitational collapse. The sun is gaseous despite its high density. We've talked about the incredible rarity of fusion. Most hydrogen nuclei in the sun haven't fused. It takes a million years for a photon to rise to the surface of the sun and exit as visible light due to the constant collisions and absorptions of energy in the interior. Yeah, we've talked about the 600 million tons of hydrogen that are converted to helium each second to produce the sun's luminosity, 4 times 10 to the 26 watts per second, 4 million tons of which are converted to pure energy because that's the mass deficit. 3% of nuclear energy is emitted as neutrinos. We'll talk about them we'll talk about them right now. Neutrinos are weakly interacting atomic particles. They are weakly interacting in the sense that they weakly interact with baryonic matter, protons, neutrons, electrons, the physical matter that we're familiar with. They do not interact with. So, as it turns out, it's estimated that there are about 35 quadrillion neutrinos that pass through every square meter of the Earth every second. And they're coming from all directions, but most of them are coming from the sun. Right at this second, as you sit here, quadrillions of neutrinos are pouring through your body, through your fingernails, everything. You don't know them. You can't detect them. They're weakly interacting. And they're, think about this. Where have they come from? The sun, which is below the horizon. So they've come through the Earth before they've passed through your body. Neutrinos. Lead, South Dakota. Anybody ever been there? Okay. There was a famous experiment where they built this huge tank that held 100,000 gallons of cleaning fluid in an abandoned gold mine 2 miles below the Earth's surface. That was some sight to see those tanker trucks bringing that chlorine liquid to fill that tank up over a period of several months. What are they doing there? Why do we need all this cleaning fluid in that abandoned gold mine? What are they up to in there? They were expected to detect one argon atom per day in that tank, and they had very sophisticated meters that could have detected this. One argon atom is the byproduct of a neutrino interacting with the chlorine. Well, as it turns out, they only found about one-third of what was expected, maybe one argon atom every 3 days, based on the existing nuclear model of the sun. Where did the other two-thirds of the neutrinos go en route to Lead, South Dakota? Well, this enigma was explained by the Canada Sudbury Neutrino Detector, which was another massive tank of volatile chemicals that detected three different kinds of neutrino. And as it was determined from that experiment, unlike the South Dakota experiment that was looking for just one kind of neutrino, the Canadian experiment determined that there are three kinds: electron neutrinos, mu, and tau neutrinos. And the nuclear reactions in the sun produce only electron neutrinos. The South Dakota experiment only detected the one-third of them, of the type of neutrinos that are emitted by the sun. The Sudbury detector in Canada looked for all three kinds of neutrinos and found them. Here's a picture of that gold mine, that subterranean gold mine in South Dakota with the 400,000 liters of dry cleaning fluid.